Wisconsin's COVID cases are skyrocketing, and last week, our state registered the highest number of people hospitalized with COVID-19 since the pandemic began. Plus, many college campuses in Wisconsin that started with in-person instruction have had to move to online instruction to try and control spikes in COVID cases. While we've been living with the reality of this pandemic for more than 6 months, there's still a lot of confusion and uncertainty about how to keep ourselves and the people we love safe. What questions do you have? There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Are you unsure of how to judge the risks of different activities? Do you wonder when and how to be tested for COVID-19? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We've got Dr. John Ohoro, who's an infectious disease specialist at Mayo Clinic Health System, joining us. He works in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and also at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. He's a graduate of the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Ohoro, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with more basic information. Right now, what do we know about the best ways to avoid being infected by this new coronavirus?
So the best measures for preventing coronavirus infection at this point have been pretty stable over the past few months, meaning we've recognized the important role of masking in public spaces, indoor spaces and crowded outdoor spaces, maintaining physical distance, hand washing, and keeping a close tab on symptoms. So if you do start to feel that you may be sick, you can avoid infecting others. It's something that even though we know these measures work, they are very difficult to really do for a prolonged period. And as this has dragged on for months and months, some of what we're seeing right now with this current spike probably reflects the general public's fatigue with all of these measures, which really are quite intrusive in our day-to-day life.
Yeah. Some of the most recent news is that this coronavirus can be spread in an aerosol form instead of just larger droplets. Can you explain the difference for us and what it means for our safety?
Sure. Aerosol and droplet exist along a continuum. What an aerosol really is a very, very small droplet. And because it doesn't weigh as much, it can travel much further than a standard droplet. Like if you were to sneeze and see the little droplets appear on your computer screen, those kinds only typically go 6 feet or less. Now, these aerosols can go significantly farther and hang around in the air for a lot longer. Now, the question that's been debated among a lot of health professionals is how significant the aerosol role is generally. There's little debate that there are definitely cases of people being infected from aerosols, but most of these have either been in very poorly ventilated spaces, which would allow the virus to stick around longer, or where there's been some sort of aerosol-generating activity going on, where either somebody's getting a medical procedure, which we know when you're working on the airway, you can cause more aerosols to be generated, or some other activities like a lot of exertion or singing in the case of a choir outbreak in Washington State a few months ago, likely generated some aerosols above and beyond the what we would normally see. From a practical standpoint, on a day-to-day basis, we don't really see much in the public from aerosol transmission that seems to be limited to these specific settings. But that's something that still is an area of open debate and investigation about under what circumstances that becomes relevant.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Ohoro. We're talking with Dr. John Ohoro about COVID-19, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Sounds like Kevin in Madison has a kind of related question here. Hey, Kevin.
I have a scheduled appointment for a regular clean and check at my dentist office. Wondering what, you know, if it's safe to do that. I think they're taking extensive precautions, but I'm still a little worried.
All right, Kevin, thanks for that question. Yeah, Dr. Ohoro, because a dentist's office is one of these places that you might encounter more aerosols.
Yeah, so dentist's office and healthcare providers generally are taking fairly extensive precautions against COVID-19. And as long as they are taking these sorts of precautions, like having people mask in the waiting room, ensuring that their staff are masked and so forth, the risk in those settings is fairly well managed and fairly low. it's something where we're seeing an increased risk of people having other conditions, other medical conditions are going unchecked because they're afraid to see physicians or dentists or other healthcare providers during COVID. And that's some of the hidden toll of this. So if you have a visit that you need to make with a healthcare provider and those appropriate measures are in place, by all means. Now, if you are somebody who has an immune compromising condition or someone who's immune compromised in your family, that is something that becomes a little bit more difficult to say for something like a cleaning, if that's necessarily worthwhile, if it's not a indicated intervention, like if you're not having something like a tooth drilled or treated, if that could be put off a little bit longer. That's a personal choice at that point, but I encourage anybody who has a medical condition to not put off their visit or discussing that with their healthcare providers because of COVID, as long as there are masks in place and appropriate precautions being taken at the healthcare facility.
There are many clinics or facilities who list information about the precautions they're taking on their websites. What if they don't, or what if you don't have internet access? Should we be asking about precautions before we show up in person?
Absolutely. I just think that that's a very appropriate thing to call ahead for, because that is most of them will be very happy to tell you exactly what they're doing and should be giving you some indication that they would expect you to be wearing a mask. And this is one of the ways that you can take your safety into your own hands, is checking to make sure that if you're going to go to such a facility, A, you're complying with what they would expect you to do, and B, they're complying with what you would expect them to do for your safety.
All right. Thanks for that explanation. And we'll make sure to ask those questions, not for just for ourselves, but for everybody. We've also got Charles on the line from Eau Claire. Hi, Charles.
Hi. I was wondering if your guest could talk about the different tests that are done and what the results mean, that you've had the coronavirus or that you're currently shedding virus. And I had a second question, too. In areas with higher air pollution, there's studies that have been done that the coronavirus can kind of hitch a ride on these particulate matter 2.5s, I believe. And I was wondering if your guest could talk about that.
All right, Charles, thanks for the question. Dr. O'Hara, do you have any experience looking at the studies with air pollution?
Yeah, so with air pollution, I'm not familiar personally with the ones about the particulates allowing it to travel further, so I can't comment on that. I do know there is a association between air pollution and worse disease, because this is a respiratory illness. So we would expect that anything that decreases air quality and increases respiratory inflammation to make it a little bit harder to fight this off and make this a little harder. So some of the things like the wildfires impact on air pollution and air quality across the U.S. are things that public health officials are keeping a close eye on with some interest as to how that will impact the pandemic.
Yeah. And then Charles is wondering about those tests, because we do hear lots of different kinds of tests and what they tell us and what they actually don't mean. Where do we start to try to understand that?
Yeah. Broadly speaking, at this point, there are two main tests. There are several others that are still entering the field, but the two main ones are the PCR-based tests, which are the nasal swab or nasal pharyngeal swab. That's the deeper swab that goes all the way to the back of the throat from the nose. And what that is looking for is the actual virus itself is looking for the genetic material to tell you that the virus is present, or at least fragments of its genetic code are. And that's used a lot in diagnosis of this because of recognition that these viral particles can continue to be shed, or at least some fragments of them can continue to persist for some time after infection. The CDC is currently recommending against retesting those for persons who are positive to demonstrate clearance, because we know that although infections being spread after 10 to 20 days is exceedingly rare, some people stay positive for weeks and months, even though they aren't transmissible. The other one is the blood test, which is usually at this point an antibody-based test. What that's looking for is evidence of prior infection. This is being used mostly in some of these seroprevalence studies, but also to help clarify some other unusual results. And that really tells you that somebody was infected, but it doesn't really tell you exactly when, and needs to be interpreted in context of that.
All right. Actually, let's keep talking about antibody tests with Mary from Wisconsin Dells, who's ready to join the conversation. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I was just wondering, my daughter got coronavirus and tested positive, didn't believe it, went back and got tested positive again. So she quarantined, and then like a month after her quarantine, she went back to test for antibodies, and she was negative. So we're just curious if she can get it again, why she wouldn't have antibodies. Could she still be, said she was negative, but we're just wondering how close we can get to her.
Oh, yeah. Mary, thanks for the call.
Yeah, so in that situation, I would definitely trust the PCR, both because it's safer for everyone else to do, and because there are a number of caveats that go with the interpretation of antibody testing and a number of ways that you can be negative. It could be that it was too soon after the initial test and that the antibody response isn't strong enough yet. It could also be that it was too far afterwards because the antibody response does taper off over time. And there is some concern that people can get reinfected. We don't know how prevalent this is with a COVID-19, but we know with other coronaviruses, like the ones that cause the common cold, that immunity doesn't necessarily persist. So there would be reason to believe that the antibodies could trail off over time. There are other parts of the immune system that may be sensitized as well. So even though that test is negative, there's also some suggestion that those with a prior infection may have a more mild infection a second time around, but this is still an area with a lot of unknowns.
And Dr. Ohoro, you said trust the PCR. Which test do we trust then?
The first test, the one that was positive in this case.
That confirmed the infection. Okay.
Mm-hmm. The one that confirmed the infection, yes.
We're talking with Dr. John Ohoro right now. He's an infectious disease specialist at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Also works at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And we're taking your calls about the new coronavirus, what you want to know about COVID-19. You can call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Still time for your call in this conversation. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina, and we're talking with Dr. John Ohoro of the Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse and the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. He's sharing the latest information on COVID-19 and taking your questions at 800-642-1234. Dr. Ohoro, with fall and winter holidays coming up, people are trying to figure out if it's safe to travel and see family or even what to do if they do get together. Where should we start to figure out how to handle these winter months?
Yeah, so it's important. The term social distancing has been abandoned largely in favor of physical distancing, to recognize that it really is important, as this has dragged on for months, for people to remain connected. And that does mean an increased role of doing things like phone calls, video calls, or other ways of staying in touch with relatives and friends. Now, as we approach the fall with things like Thanksgiving and the holidays thereafter, it will be more challenging to control spread if people congregate in the way they would in past years. That wouldn't be advisable to have large family gatherings like you may have in prior years. In that same vein, if it's not strictly forbidden to do so for people who are maintaining appropriate precautions with each other. This gets into what's called the bubble approach, which has been discussed a few times with things like the in professional sports, where you have a group of people who are essentially exposed to one another, and accept that within that small bubble, which might be a family, it might be roommates, it might be a very small group, you can still get together, but that bubble has to remain small enough that you can really enforce that everybody within that group is taking responsibility for that community's health. So get togethers using a bubble approach may be a strategy that people use this upcoming fall and winter. But that's something that takes a lot of attention to detail and a lot of trust of the members of your group.
Yeah. Let's talk with Anjali in Madison now. Anjali, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yes, I have a similar question to the bubble question, but specifically with respect to children. I have two daughters, and both, one is in middle school and one is in high school, and each has a friend with whom they would like to form a pod. And I'm wondering, how does the bubble approach work or the pod approach work? Do people have to get tested regularly to make sure that they are still healthy? Or how do we, even though we're, you know, pretty much quarantining and keeping to ourselves in a small group, how does the bubble approach or the pod approach work?
Anjali, thanks for the question. Similar but different to the conversation about holidays.
Yeah, that's a great question on the pods there. And there are no hard and fast rules on this, but I'll give some general principles that I follow and advise on this. One of them is your group should be at a size where it's small enough that you really understand who is in that group, which is to say that if you have another family who is participating in two pods because they have two daughters in the situation that you're in here, you know that their pod effectively includes yours. So you should really have a good understanding, be able to get a grasp on who is involved, because as that chain spreads out, the effectiveness of this as a mitigation measure gets lower. Secondly, everyone in there should be very responsible about the activities like masking, hand hygiene, physical distancing, because you really are trusting everyone in that to protect your pod or bubble community. Third, and this is probably the single most important thing that I recommend, is within that there has to be no social repercussions for canceling plans at the last minute. I say that because it's very important that if any member of that group starts to question whether or not they're unwell, they should have a free pass to say, you know what, we're going to call off the play date, the dinner, or whatever else is going to be, because that's how you would keep your pod safe. Testing of asymptomatic persons or regular testing isn't part of any routine pods in the general public at this point, and that's something that may change as this goes forward. Some of the sports teams have used that, but that's not something that I require of my own bubble, for example, at this point. But that's something that is going to, that may evolve as the testing changes and the testing availability continues to change.
Dr. Ohoro, then, if you don't get tested in the beginning, would you, if you're just starting up a bubble or a pod, would you everybody separately quarantine for a certain amount of time first before then getting together more regularly?
So a lot of that depends on how well you know your pod members and what they've been doing. In my own group, I happen to know that everybody was effectively quarantined before we decided to start to do some pod activities for socialization of children and so forth. So that I'm not sure I would require it to restart at that point, but it all depends on how well you know that pod and if somebody is entering it who suspects that they may have had some exposure. That comes back to that responsibility and the freedom to cancel plans to say, you know what, I'm out of the pod for the next 2 weeks because I, now that I think of it, I'm at high risk.
Yeah. Dr. John Ohoro is an infectious disease specialist at Mayo Clinic Health System. He works here in Wisconsin and in Minnesota. We're talking about COVID-19. We've got Dwayne from Weston who has a question. Hi, Dwayne.
Oh, good afternoon. So early on from China, the epidemiologist over there, they said they noticed people with O-type blood that were getting it less severe or not getting it to the near percentage of other types. And then it kind of died down on that. You never heard anything. And then later on, a couple months ago, there was a published report over here about it. And I was just wondering if he's heard of that and if there's any validity to it, you know, and what, you know, that might explain why some people get just the sniffles over like full scale, you know, symptoms.
Yeah. Dwayne, thanks for that question. Because Dr. Ohoro, we've heard from health experts who say we don't know who's going to get this really bad and who's just going to have a minor issue with COVID-19. Do we know if blood type has anything to do with it at this point?
Yeah, so there is definitely some evidence to suggest that blood type plays a role. And as the caller indicated, O-type blood may be at lower risk. There's some thought that might have to do with some of the antibodies that are associated with different blood types or some of the clotting factors. But what's not really clear is how significant this role is or if that's going to pan out in the long term as being a significant risk factor. Because this disease seems to be very multifactorial. When we look at who gets really sick and who doesn't, it usually isn't just one risk factor. We're looking at the cumulative risks that come from things like age, gender. Males are much more likely to get more severe disease and different comorbid conditions. And a big part of this is comorbidities, other conditions that we just might not know about as of yet. So it's very plausible and very interesting to think that blood type might be a part of this, but how big a role that plays is very uncertain right now.
Let's fit one more call into this jam-packed discussion. We've got Erica in Lansing, Iowa. Hi, Erica.
Hi. I'm wondering about the antibody testing, kind of getting back to that. So does the antibody testing test specifically for COVID-19, or is it just looking at coronavirus? So, you know, like the coronavirus that causes the common cold, or is it very specific to COVID-19?
Erica, thanks for the question. Dr. Ohoro.
Yeah, there's a variety of different lab tests out there at this point, and some of them are looking at different targets, but they really are trying, and most of them do target specifically for COVID-19. Now, there is the possibility of there being some cross-reactivity between COVID-19 and other coronaviruses, depending on the test. It's something that hasn't been really all that well studied, but the antibody tests that I'm most familiar with that are used by some of the major institutions tend to be fairly specific to COVID-19.
Dr. Ohoro, thank you so much for answering all of the questions that remain, and I'm sure we'll talk with you about this in the future as we figure out how to live during this pandemic. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Dr. John Ohoro is an infectious disease specialist at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse, Wisconsin. He also works at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and we've been talking about the COVID-19 pandemic.